Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now we turn our attention to the disputed region of Kashmir, which is once again in the middle of a conflict between the neighboring nuclear powers, Hindu-majority India and Muslim-majority Pakistan. Both India and Pakistan lay claim to portions of Kashmir and have gone to war twice over gaining more control over the region. The latest drama, if you haven't been following it yet, began earlier this month when India essentially annexed Kashmir by revoking a special status which had granted the region some degrees of autonomy. Since then, much of Kashmir has been living in a total media blackout with no access to the internet or phones, though those restrictions, we are told, are easing somewhat. Troops from both India and Pakistan are being deployed, and some civilians have been killed in the crossfire. Now, just yesterday, President Trump announced that he would mediate the tensions in the region. Maybe this will be right after he buys Greenland, but listen.
Prime Minister Khan was here just recently, and I'm going to be with Prime Minister Modi. I'll be with him over the weekend in France. So, you know, I think we're helping the situation, but there's tremendous problems between those two countries, as you know. And I will do the best I can to mediate or do something. Great relationship with both of them, but they are not exactly friends at this moment.
With me now to discuss the geopolitics of the region and help take calls for many of you listening right now with ties to Kashmir itself or India or Pakistan generally is Hafsa Khanjwal, South Asian history professor at Lafayette College. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you explain to a global audience, many of whom may not be familiar at all with Kashmir, its basic status and the origins of that?
Yes. So Kashmir is a region, as you mentioned, that's disputed between India and Pakistan. But what I think is important for the global audience to understand is that it was a space that was independent. Even during colonial rule, it was its own princely state. After the Indian subcontinent was partitioned, India and Pakistan went to war over the region, and India took over 2/3, Pakistan took over 1/3. But Kashmiri people were never able to determine their own future, and that's kind of what lies at the root of the situation, is that they were promised, according to a UN resolution in 1948, a plebiscite to figure out whether they would want to join India or Pakistan. In the past 70-plus years, they have not been able to do so. So for Kashmiris, especially those who live in the Indian occupied side, they consider themselves to be occupied. They see India as a colonial power that has not allowed them the right to express their political will.
And even people without connections to the region probably know vaguely that it's the, quote, disputed region of Kashmir, and India and Pakistan have been in this somewhat tug of war over it for all these decades. But why is this bubbling up now to more of a conflict than it was recently?
So, to be honest, Kashmir has been bubbling up for a long time. The latest kind of uprising against Indian rule began in 2008. And since then, each summer has been very violent. Young people have protested on the streets, and the Indian armed forces that are there have fired live ammunition and pellets. But what happens is that it does those kinds of moments within Kashmir, because India is able to declare it as an internal matter, don't really make it into the international media's attention. What's happened here is that Modi took this unilateral step without even consulting, the parliamentary process within India, the constitutional process within India, to abrogate Kashmir's special status under the Indian constitution. So by doing that, he basically went against international law, went against the Indian constitution itself, which is why the issue kind of was raised to gain more attention from international actors, especially Pakistan and the UN and other spaces. But besides that, people have lived under constant sort of repression. And even though right now the media is under a blockade, the internet goes off in Kashmir over 50 times every year. It's one of the spaces where the internet and communication blackouts happen quite frequently. So this is just an escalation of things that have been going on in Kashmir for a long time.
So listeners, call in and help us explain this story. If you have connections to the region, to Kashmir itself, or to India or Pakistan generally, what does it mean that Prime Minister Modi revoked this Article 370, which we'll explain in a second? What are the stakes? And if you have family in Kashmir, have you been able to reach them with this media and even phone blackout? And what are you thinking? What do you want everybody else to know matters here to people? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 with Hofstra Kanwal, South Asian history professor at Lafayette College. Professor, can you explain Article 370 and what the revocation of it means?
Yes, sure. So Article 370 was agreed upon in the Indian Constitution by the local Kashmiri leadership at the time, which actually was not representative. They were put in place by the Indian government to serve as a sort of a client regime. But they agreed to serve as a client regime as long as Kashmir had its autonomy within the Indian Union. And Article 370 enshrined that autonomy, that Kashmir would have its own constitution, it would have its own prime minister, it would have its own flag, but that India would take over foreign affairs, defense, and communications. Over time, in the past 70 years, that autonomy has been decreased, has been challenged in a number of different ways. Kashmir doesn't have a prime minister anymore, for example. It's a chief minister, as with other Indian states. But the one thing that was important is another part of Article 370 and the Indian Constitution, which is Article 35A, where the local Kashmiri state could kind of define what a permanent resident of the state was. And only permanent residents of the state could buy land and property, have employment, and get certain scholarships from the government. Now, with Article 370 and 35A under threat, what's happening is that it opens up the possibilities for Indians from India to go into Kashmir, buy land, buy businesses, and basically drive out the local population from the region. So Kashmiris feel that this is, even though their autonomy has been already kind of under threat for quite some time, for them this is more of an existential threat because it's a life or death situation for them. And there's already been plans in the works with big businesses like Ambani's and Tata and Reliance to go into Kashmir and set up their businesses and investments. And people are not happy about that. This is not what they want, even though India has kind of touted this as a move for economic development. It's not being done with the consent of the local people. And because of the communication blackout, many of them don't even know that this is happening.
I see that schools reopened this week after being shuttered in Kashmir, but Reuters reported that at least in one school with 1,000 students enrolled, only one student showed up because parents are too fearful to send their kids out in the streets or for a full school day. Does that ring true to you?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we saw some images of some of the schools on the day that, the government said that they could go back to school, and nobody went into school. It's for their safety. I mean, the young kids, if they venture out of their homes, they're going to be met with an even greater deployment of armed forces who often beat people up. A number of children, not just like young men or teenagers, but children as young as 11 have been detained and tortured. We know this because a fact-finding mission from India actually went into Kashmir and came out with a report called Kashmir Caged. The situation for all Kashmiris, men, women, and children right now is completely insecure. So there's no way that parents would send their children to school. And in addition to that, parents would also not send their children to school in protest of this, the farce of normalcy that the Indian state is trying to put forth right now.
Let's take a phone call. Here's Rajund in Middlesex County. You're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, Brian. Interesting show as always. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my point here is that I think some of the stuff that your guest is also saying is true. But if you take it in the bigger context, all of India suffers from the same problem. There are problems like this all over the place. There are problems in Israel like this. So my point is that you can either, you know, go back and keep blaming India to be the evil empire that it is. And again, I'm not saying all of India suffers from similar issues. The rest of the country where there hasn't been a problem like this has similar issues. But my point is, for the last 70 years, we also need to talk about the corruption that was there in the politics of Kashmir, and the people who were taking money, and the terrorism that was happening, either state-sponsored from across the border or from within the country. So nothing was being done for the last 70 years. This is the first time this guy has said that, I am not a Modi supporter, I don't like him. But this is the first time he is saying that he is going to do something, and he is making an effort to do something. I think that all that needs to be discussed in context, mm-hmm. and he needs to be given a decent amount of chance rather than just point out all the problems. Everything else that you're saying happens to the rest of the country also. It happens in MP, it happens in UP, it happens in some of the other states also. But we are not talking about those. We're only talking about Kashmir and making out everything that is happening there to be evil without discussing the context.
Let me ask you one follow-up question, and then we'll get Professor Cantwell's response. Do you think that the idea that's been getting out, that Modi has unleashed mass suffering in pursuit of a vision of Hindutva, do they call it, in India that is largely or even exclusively for the Hindus, is not at the root of this?
No, I mean, it might be related to that, but I don't see what I'm saying is, whatever you're saying is true for the rest of the country also, but we're not discussing that. We're only discussing Kashmir, and we're only pointing out issues in Kashmir,
which has a special status. But Professor, how would you respond to the issues that Rajan is raising about context?
Just to give you one quick example, when there are protests in Kashmir, they are not met with, you know, water, fire, or, you know, just like the protests are not dealt with as they are with other spaces in India. They're met with live ammunition and pellet guns. This is not used in any other state in India. So absolutely, I disagree with the caller that Kashmir is just like any other state in India. Kashmir has a special status that is not just even within the Indian constitution, but also it's an international dispute. The UN has multiple resolutions on the state of Jammu and Kashmir, and this is not like any other state in India. Of course, there are problems around India with corruption and what have you, but Kashmir is separate from that. It has a completely different political trajectory than other regions. In relation to the comment about development and all of these other issues that the caller raised, the corrupt leaders in Kashmir, the number one people who are against those corrupt leaders are the Kashmiris themselves. The Indian state, as I mentioned before, was the one that put in these client regimes of local Kashmiris, who they basically funneled with a ton of money to kind of serve as their collaborators and overrule the Kashmiri people. So even the Kashmiris themselves are against those corrupt regimes. They've been wanting transparency. They've been wanting democracy for time immemorial. So the excuses that have been used in terms of development and corruption, these are all distractions. These are all distractions from the main issue, which is that the Kashmiris have not been able to express their political rights. There's a number of human rights violations that have been ongoing. And in terms of Hindutva, I mean, the BJP and Hindu nationalist parties have, since 1947, wanted to abrogate Kashmir's special status, and this has been their plan all along. This is a way for them to solidify their base and to make sure that they are, you know, they are seen as authoritative, because this step, of course, has a significant popularity within India. So they use Kashmir as a kind of a pawn to solidify their power and authority, and then from there they will go on to other regions. I mean, already any kind of dissent against India, forget in Kashmir, but even in India, by people who are questioning the Modi government, they're called anti-nationals. They're called, you know, they're told to go back to Pakistan, even if they're not Pakistani or not even Muslim. So there's, I mean, there's
Gee,
no
where
doubt.
Have I heard that before in this country? But never mind, that's another show.
Yes, exactly. It's very, I mean, these are very similar kind of regimes, Trump, Modi, Netanyahu, that use these kind of distractions to get to take people's minds away from the actual issues that are happening. Right now, India is suffering economically. Modi knows that. His government knows that. Farmers have been committing suicide in India. in really dramatic numbers, but you won't hear about that. All you hear is that there's certain trade deals that are being made, defense deals that are being made. And the Indian American community in the US, unfortunately, has also pushed forth this vision of India as this great kind of economic, secular power. Incredible India is the motto that's been pushed around. But that's not the case. Ask the minorities in India who have to live under this government.
I think we have a call kind of to that effect on one side of it. Shangar in Hillsborough, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. I was just going to say that since for the last 75 years, violence in Kashmir has increased and it's become worse and worse. India, in parallel, has now become almost a world power. It has a rocket going around the moon. And I think with the 370 article done away with, Kashmir now will have an opportunity really to develop and come on par with India. Pakistan and India 75 years ago were almost on the same level economically. Today, Pakistan is almost 30 to 40 years behind India. So, and even one of the leading Muslim businessmen in India, who is a CEO of Wipro, he made a statement that the Muslims in India are far better off than Muslims in Pakistan. So I really don't see the problem here, to be honest.
Shangar, I know Pakistanis and Muslim Kashmiris who might have heard that are just tearing their hair out right now. I remember hearing something similar. I've lived long enough, Professor, to have heard people say when South Africa was still an apartheid state, look at the prosperity in South Africa compared to African countries that are black run, that people are migrating into South Africa from other countries because they can be more prosperous. And I don't know, maybe that's too harsh. It rings to me like that.
I completely agree with you there. And there's also this way in which, you know, for me, the issue, Pakistan is an important actor because they have an investment in the issue of Kashmir as well. But there's a way in which a lot of Indians and Indian Americans will not directly address what India is doing in Kashmir and only bring up Pakistan as this kind of bogey. Right? Like, you cannot have a conversation about what India is doing in Kashmir without just bringing up Pakistan, even though, for people on the ground, their issue is actually not with Pakistan. I myself have a lot of criticism of Pakistan, but Pakistan is not the one that's put the entire region under a communication blockade and, you know, militarized the region with over 700,000 troops. So these are all, to me, distracting conversations that push away from the root of the issue. And I don't think economic development should be measured by what a country's GDP is. I mean, we have economists now who have been pushing back against these understandings of thinking about the economy. I mean, the fact that India has a rocket launcher around the moon when a significant majority of its population lives in poverty is actually quite appalling to me. That's not something to be proud of.
You know, it's so interesting. We can see from our board, and we don't have time to keep going on this, but most of the callers are of Indian background, and we can really see, I can see, just sitting here and looking at my caller board, how polarized this is, because people are objecting to a lot of your analysis, and people are putting forth various arguments in support of the Indian government position, not to say that they're right or wrong, I'm saying just how it's so apparent how polarized it is. A caller we won't have time for says millions of dollars are going from India and not reaching the Kashmir people, indicating corruption. Another one says, oh, the media has slanted reporting on India. A similar thing is done in Pakistan without any commotion, meaning, you know, slanted coverage and bias pro-Pakistan there, but nobody complains. Another one says what the guest is saying is not true. The majority of people in Kashmir, let me get the rest of that, majority of people are happy with the decisions, and only a minority of Muslims are not happy. Maybe all of that is true, but all of that reflects, I guess, if nothing else, how polarized the situation is.
I think what it reflects is that people, unfortunately, only see political political issues from their nationalist biases and from their nationalist perspectives. And what I would encourage all of your listeners to do is to look at this from the perspective of humanity. I mean, there's a people here who have been suffering for over 70 years. They have made their voice quite clear about what their demands are, and they're not being listened to. And you know, because there is kind of a general climate of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism in India, Kashmiris are kind of just dehumanized completely because of their religious background. So I would hope that listeners, whether they're Indian or Pakistani, are able to get out of their nationalist perspectives and just see this as a human issue, and really, really challenge some of their inherent biases that they carry on this.
What about, from an Indian perspective, the responsibility of people in Kashmir, Muslims in Kashmir in particular, to not engage in uprisings that can turn violent?
So Kashmiri Muslims have peacefully protested for a vast majority of their history. Even in the 1950s and 60s, there was a movement called a plebiscite front that was peacefully demanding the right to self-determination and the right to a plebiscite. Now, in the late 80s, because of different things that were happening around the globe, the end of the Cold War, the Soviet jihad in Afghanistan, or the Afghan jihad against the Soviets, the region just became militarized in general. And there was one election in particular that was completely rigged. Kashmiris who were for freedom actually tried to use the electoral process within India to come to power. That election was rigged, and as a result, people felt that they had no other option besides the armed struggle. So, I mean, it's always interesting to me that the occupying force, which is so violent and so visceral itself, demands that the people who have been oppressed, who've had their lives taken away from them, resort to peace. And they have. Kashmiris, even in 2008, all of those protests were peaceful. Unfortunately, India did not allow people to gather peacefully, which is why young men started to use stones or, a number of them. A very small minority joined the armed rebellion again. But the question of violence, the morality of violence, does not belong to the Kashmiri people. It belongs to the occupying power.
Let's take one more call before we run out of time. Dr. Gupta in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Hello, Dr. Gupta.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to your program for a long time, and I love your show.
Thank you.
So a couple of things. So, Brian, I'm from Jammu, part of Jammu and Kashmir. And majority of the Jammu and Kashmir are very, very happy by this change of status. It's called Article 370, because all the money which came in from the central government only went to Kashmir, and a lot of people became very, very corrupt because of that. So that few corruption people, they are the one who are very, very unhappy, and that's a very minority of the Muslims who are very unhappy because of this. Majority of the people are very happy with this. One thing this professor made a mistake was, it was very well approved by the 2/3 of the majority in the parliament in India, and only then it was affected. It is very well, I mean, you can go back to your Indian stuff, so it's already approved, and only then it came in effect.
And I'm going to jump in because we're just about out of time for the segment, but I hear your point. And by the luck of the draw, I mean, not to say we're lucky, just by the randomness of just having a few lines and people calling in, it's all been Indian, or I think in the case of Dr. Gupta there, Hindu Kashmiri, no Muslim or Pakistani in callers in this segment, though we've had many in the past. Professor Kanjwal, in a certain respect, they see you as representing that other side, and people are complaining. But to Dr. Gupta's point at the end, that most of the Muslim people in Kashmir are happy, it's a small minority who are unhappy, drawing all this attention and leading to all this conflict, what would you say? And we've got 30 seconds left.
I would say, why don't you ask them? Ask them what they actually think. But unfortunately, they won't be able to talk to you because they're under a huge communication blockade. They're in a curfew. So if they were really happy, then they should be out celebrating and partying on the streets. We've seen images from the BBC and other international media of protests of Kashmiri men, women, and children out in protest despite the curfew. And these images have, you know, journalists have not been able to really access the region. But let's wait and see. Why don't you ask them in a couple of days, once this communication blockade is lifted, what they think? But they've already let their impressions known. So there's really nothing else to talk about in that sense.
And there's nothing else to talk about in this segment because we're out of time. Hafsa Khanjwal, professor of South Asian history at Lafayette College, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.